it became harder to dismiss all that information as pure fantasy. Could it be that the entire silo of witch-hunting data did not contain a single grain of truth in it? What about all the books written by learned churchmen? What about all the protocols of trials conducted by esteemed judges? What about the tens of thousands of documented confessions? The new intersubjective reality was so convincing that even some people accused of witchcraft came to believe that they were indeed part of a worldwide satanic conspiracy. If everybody said so, it must be true. As discussed in Chapter 2, humans are susceptible to adopting fake memories. At least some early modern Europeans dreamed or fantasized about summoning devils, having sex with Satan, and practicing witchcraft. And when accused of being witches, they confused their dreams and fantasies with reality. Consequently, even as the witch hunts reached their ghastly crescendo in the early 17th century, and many people suspected that something was clearly wrong, it was difficult to reject the whole thing as pure fantasy. One of the worst witch-hunting episodes in early modern Europe occurred in the towns of Bamberg and Würzburg in southern Germany in the late 1620s. In Bamberg, a city of fewer than 12,000 at the time, up to 900 innocent people were executed from 1625 to 1631. In Würzburg, another 1,200 people were tortured and killed, out of a population of around 11,500. In August 1629, the Chancellor of the Prince Bishop of Würzburg wrote a letter to a friend about the ongoing witch hunt, in which he confessed his doubts about the matter. The letter is worth quoting at length. "As to the affair of the witches, it has started up afresh, and no words can do justice to it. Ah, the woe and the misery of it! There are still 400 in the city, high and low, of every rank and sex, nay, even clerics, so strongly accused that they may be arrested at any hour. The Prince Bishop has over 40 students who are soon to be pastors, among them 13 or 14 are said to be witches. A few days ago, a dean was arrested, two others who were summoned have fled. The notary of our church consistory, a very learned man, was yesterday arrested and put to the torture. In a word, a third part of the city is surely involved. The richest, most attractive, most prominent of the clergy are already executed. A week ago, a maiden of 19 was executed, of whom it is everywhere said that she was the fairest in the whole city, and was held by everybody a girl of singular modesty and purity. She will be followed by 7 or 8 others of the best and most attractive persons, and thus many are put to death for renouncing God and being at the witch dances, against whom nobody has ever else spoken a word. To conclude this wretched matter, there are children of 3 and 4 years, to the number of 300, who are said to have had intercourse with the devil. I have seen put to death children of 7, promising students of 10, 12, 14, and 15. But I cannot and must not write more of this misery." The Chancellor then added this interesting postscript to the letter. "Though there are many wonderful and terrible things happening, it is beyond doubt that, at a place called the Frau Rengberg, the devil in person, with 8,000 of his followers, held an assembly and celebrated mass before them all, administering to his audience, that is, the witches, turnip rinds and parings in place of the Holy Eucharist. There took place not only foul but most horrible and hideous blasphemies, whereof I shudder to write." Even after expressing his horror at the insanity of the witch hunt in Würzburg, the Chancellor nevertheless expressed his firm belief in the satanic conspiracy of witches. He didn't witness any witchcraft firsthand, but so much information about witches was circulating that it was difficult for him to doubt all of it. Witch hunts were a catastrophe caused by the spread of toxic information. They are a prime example of a problem that was created by information and was made worse by more information. This was a conclusion reached not just by modern scholars, but also by some perceptive observers at the time. Alonso de Salazar Frias, a Spanish inquisitor, made a thorough investigation of witch hunts and witch trials in the early 17th century. He concluded that he had not found one single proof, nor even the slightest indication, from which to infer that one act of witchcraft has actually taken place, and that there were neither witches nor bewitched until they were talked and written about. Salazar Frias well understood the meaning of intersubjective realities, and correctly identified the entire witch hunting industry as an intersubjective information sphere. The history of the early modern European witch craze demonstrates that releasing barriers to the flow of information doesn't necessarily lead to the discovery and spread of truth. It can just as easily lead to the spread of lies and fantasies, and to the creation of toxic information spheres. More specifically, a completely free market of ideas may incentivize the dissemination of outrage and sensationalism at the expense of truth. It is not difficult to understand why. Printers and booksellers made a lot more money from the lurid tales of the Hammer of the Witches than they did from the dull mathematics of Copernicus's On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. The latter was one of the founding texts of the modern scientific tradition. It is credited with earth-shattering discoveries that displaced our planet from the center of the universe and thereby initiated the Copernican Revolution. But when it was first published in 1543, its initial print run of 400 failed to sell out, and it took until 1566 for a second edition to be published in a similar-sized print run. The third edition did not appear until 1617. As Arthur Koestler quipped, it was an all-time worst seller. What really got the scientific revolution going was neither the printing press nor a completely free market of information, but rather a novel approach to the problem of human fallibility. The discovery of ignorance. The history of print and witch hunting indicates that an unregulated information market doesn't necessarily lead people to identify and correct their errors, because it may well prioritize outrage over truth. For truth to win, it is necessary to establish curation institutions that have the power to tilt the balance in favor of the facts. However, as the history of the Catholic Church indicates, such institutions might use their curation power to quash any criticism of themselves, labeling all alternative views erroneous and preventing the institution's own errors from being exposed and corrected. Is it possible to establish better curation institutions that use their power to further the pursuit of truth rather than to accumulate more power for themselves? Early modern Europe saw the foundation of exactly such curation institutions, and it was these institutions, rather than the printing press or specific books like On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres, that constituted the bedrock of the scientific revolution. These key curation institutions were not the universities. Many of the most important leaders of the scientific revolution were not university professors. Nicolaus Copernicus, Robert Boyle, Tycho Brahe, and René Descartes, for example, held no academic positions. Nor did Spinoza, Leibniz, Locke, Berkeley, Voltaire, Diderot, or Rousseau. The curation institutions that played a central role in the scientific revolution connected scholars and researchers both in and out of universities, forging an information network that spanned the whole of Europe and eventually the world. For the scientific revolution to gather pace, scientists had to trust information published by colleagues in distant lands. This kind of trust in the work of people whom one had never met was evident in scientific associations like the Royal Society of London for Improving Natural Knowledge, founded in 1660, and the French Académie des Sciences, 1666, Scientific journals like the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, 1665, and the Histoire de l'Académie Royale des Sciences, 1699, and scientific publishers like the architects of the Encyclopédie, 1751-72. These institutions curated information on the basis of empirical evidence, bringing attention to the discoveries of Copernicus rather than to the fantasies of Cramer. When a paper was submitted to the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the lead question the editors asked was not how many people would pay to read this, but what proof is there that this is true? At first, these new institutions seemed as flimsy as cobwebs, lacking the power necessary to reshape human society. Unlike the witch-hunting experts, the editors of the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society could not torture and execute anyone. And unlike the Catholic Church, the Académie des Sciences did not command huge territories and budgets. But scientific institutions did accrue influence thanks to a very original claim to trust. A church typically told people to trust it because it possessed the absolute truth in the form of an infallible holy book. A scientific institution, in contrast, gained authority because it had strong self-correcting mechanisms that exposed and rectified the errors of the institution itself. It was these self-correcting mechanisms, not the technology of printing, that were the engine of the scientific revolution. In other words, the scientific revolution was launched by the discovery of ignorance. Religions of the book assumed that they had access to an infallible source of knowledge. The Christians had the Bible, the Muslims had the Quran, the Hindus had the Vedas, and the Buddhists had the Tripitaka. Scientific culture has no comparable holy book, nor does it claim that any of its heroes are infallible prophets, saints, or geniuses. The scientific project starts by rejecting the fantasy of infallibility and proceeding to construct an information network that takes error to be inescapable. Sure, there is much talk about the genius of Copernicus, Darwin, and Einstein, but none of them is considered faultless. They all made mistakes, and even the most celebrated scientific tracts are sure to contain errors and lacunae. Since even geniuses suffer from confirmation bias, you cannot trust them to correct their own errors. Science is a team effort, relying on institutional collaboration rather than on individual scientists or, say, a single infallible book. Of course, institutions too are prone to error. Scientific institutions are nevertheless different from religious institutions, inasmuch as they reward skepticism and innovation rather than conformity. Scientific institutions are also different from conspiracy theories, inasmuch as they reward self-skepticism. Conspiracy theorists tend to be extremely skeptical regarding the existing consensus, but when it comes to their own beliefs, they lose all their skepticism and fall prey to confirmation bias. The trademark of science is not merely skepticism, but self-skepticism. And at the heart of every scientific institution, we find a strong self-correcting mechanism. Scientific institutions do reach a broad consensus about the accuracy of certain theories, such as quantum mechanics or the theory of evolution, but only because these theories have managed to survive intense efforts to disprove them, launched not only by outsiders, but by members of the institution itself. Self-correcting mechanisms. As an information technology, the self-correcting mechanism is the polar opposite of the holy book. The holy book is supposed to be infallible. The self-correcting mechanism embraces fallibility. By self-correcting, I refer to mechanisms that an entity uses to correct itself. A teacher correcting a student's essay is not a self-correcting mechanism. The student isn't correcting their own essay. A judge sending a criminal to prison is not a self-correcting mechanism. The criminal isn't exposing their own crime. When the Allies defeated and dismantled the Nazi regime, this was not a self-correcting mechanism. Left to its own devices, Germany would not have denazified itself. But when a scientific journal publishes a paper correcting a mistake that appeared in a previous paper, that's an example of institutional self-correction. Self-correcting mechanisms are ubiquitous in nature. Children learn how to walk thanks to them. You make a wrong move, you fall, you learn from your mistake, you try doing it a little differently. Sure, sometimes parents and teachers give the child a hand or offer advice, but a child who relies entirely on such external corrections or keeps excusing mistakes instead of learning from them will find it very difficult to walk. Indeed, even as adults, every time we walk, our body engages in an intricate process of self-correction. As our body navigates through space, internal feedback loops between brain, limbs, and sensory organs keep our legs and hands in their proper places and our balance just right. Many other bodily processes require constant self-correction. Our blood pressure, temperature, sugar levels, and numerous other parameters must be given some leeway to change in accordance with varying circumstances, but they should never go above or below certain critical thresholds. Our blood pressure needs to increase when we run, to decrease when we sleep, but must always keep within certain bounds. Our body manages this delicate biochemical dance through a host of homeostatic self-correcting mechanisms. If our blood pressure goes too high, the self-correcting mechanisms lower it. If our blood pressure is dangerously low, the self-correcting mechanisms raise it. If the self-correcting mechanisms go out of order, we could die. Institutions, too, die without self-correcting mechanisms. These mechanisms start with the realization that humans are fallible and corruptible. But instead of despairing of humans and looking for a way to bypass them, the institution actively seeks its own errors and corrects them. All institutions that manage to endure beyond a handful of years possess such mechanisms, but institutions differ greatly in the strength and visibility of their self-correcting mechanisms. For example, the Catholic Church is an institution with relatively weak self-correcting mechanisms. Since it claims infallibility, it cannot admit institutional mistakes. It is occasionally willing to acknowledge that some of its members have erred or sinned, but the institution itself allegedly remains perfect. For example, in the Second Vatican Council in 1964, the Catholic Church acknowledged that Christ summons the Church to continual reformation as she sojourns here on earth. The Church is always in need of this, insofar as she is an institution of men here on earth. Thus, if, in various times and circumstances, there have been deficiencies in moral conduct or in church discipline, or even in the way that church teaching has been formulated, to be carefully distinguished from the deposit of faith itself, these can and should be set right at the opportune moment. This admission sounds promising, but the devil is in the details, specifically in the refusal to countenance the possibility of any deficiency in the deposit of faith. In Catholic dogma, the deposit of faith refers to the body of revealed truth that the Church has received from Scriptures and from its sacred tradition of interpreting Scripture. The Catholic Church acknowledges that priests are fallible humans who can sin and can also make mistakes in the way they formulate Church teachings. However, the Holy Book itself can never err. What does this imply about the entire Church as an institution that combines fallible humans with an infallible text? According to Catholic dogma, biblical infallibility and divine guidance trump human corruption. So even though individual members of the Church may err and sin, the Catholic Church as an institution is never wrong. Allegedly, never in history did God allow the majority of church leaders to make a serious mistake in their interpretation of the Holy Book. This principle is common to many religions. Jewish Orthodoxy accepted the possibility that the rabbis who composed the Mishnah and Talmud might have erred in personal matters, but when they came to decree religious doctrine, God ensured that they would make no mistake. In Islam, there is an analogous principle known as ijma. According to one important hadith, Muhammad said that Allah will ensure my community will never agree on error. In Catholicism, alleged institutional perfection is enshrined most clearly in the doctrine of papal infallibility, which says that while in personal matters popes may err, in their institutional role they are infallible. For example, Pope Alexander VI erred in breaking his vow of celibacy, having a mistress and siring several children, yet when defining official church teachings on matters of ethics or theology, he was incapable of mistake. In line with these views, the Catholic Church has always employed a self-correcting mechanism to supervise its human members in their personal affairs, but it never developed a mechanism for amending the Bible or for amending its deposit of faith. This attitude is manifest in the few formal apologies the Catholic Church issued for its past conduct. In recent decades, several popes apologized for the mistreatment of Jews, women, non-Catholic Christians, and indigenous cultures, as well as for more specific events such as the sacking of Constantinople in 1204 and the abuse of children in Catholic schools. It is commendable that the Catholic Church made such apologies at all. Religious institutions rarely do so. Nevertheless, in all these cases, the popes were careful to shift responsibility away from scriptures and from the church as an institution. Instead, the blame was laid on the shoulders of individual churchmen who misinterpreted scriptures and deviated from the true teachings of the church. For example, in March 2000, Pope John Paul II conducted a special ceremony in which he asked forgiveness for a long list of historical crimes against Jews, heretics, women, and indigenous people. He apologized for the use of violence that some have committed in the service of truth. This terminology implied that the violence was the fault of some misguided individuals who didn't understand the truth taught by the church. The Pope didn't accept the possibility that perhaps these individuals understood exactly what the church was teaching and that these teachings just were not the truth. Similarly, when Pope Francis apologized in 2022 for the abuses against indigenous people in Canada's church-run residential schools, he said, "I ask for forgiveness, in particular, for the ways in which many members of the church cooperated in projects of cultural destruction and forced assimilation." Note his careful shifting of responsibility. The fault lay with many members of the church, not with the church and its teachings. As if it were never official church doctrine to destroy indigenous cultures and forcefully convert people. In fact, it wasn't a few wayward priests who launched the Crusades, imposed laws that discriminated against Jews and women, or orchestrated the systematic annihilation of indigenous religions throughout the world. The writings of many revered church fathers and the official decrees of many popes and church councils are full of passages disparaging pagan and heretical religions, calling for their destruction, discriminating against their members, and legitimizing the use of violence to convert people to Christianity. For example, in 1452, Pope Nicholas V issued the Dum Diversus Bull, addressed to King Alfonso V of Portugal and other Catholic monarchs. The bull said, "We grant you by these present documents, with our apostolic authority, full and free permission to invade, search out, capture and subjugate the Saracens and pagans and any other unbelievers and enemies of Christ wherever they may be, as well as their kingdoms, duchies, counties, principalities and other property, and to reduce their persons into perpetual servitude." This official proclamation, repeated numerous times by subsequent popes, laid the theological basis for European imperialism and the destruction of native cultures across the world. Of course, though the Church doesn't acknowledge it officially, over time it has changed its institutional structures, its core teachings, and its interpretation of Scripture. The Catholic Church of today is far less anti-Semitic and misogynist than it was in medieval and early modern times. Pope Francis is far more tolerant of indigenous cultures than was Pope Nicholas V. There is an institutional self-correcting mechanism at work here, which reacts both to external pressures and to internal soul-searching. But what characterizes self-correcting in institutions like the Catholic Church is that even when it happens, it is denied rather than celebrated. The first rule of changing church teachings is that you never admit to changing church teachings. You would never hear a pope announcing to the world, "Our experts have just discovered a really big error in the Bible. We'll soon issue an updated edition." Instead, when asked about the church's more generous attitude to Jews or women, popes implied that this was always what the church really taught, even if some individual churchmen previously failed to understand the message correctly. Denying the existence of self-correction doesn't entirely stop it from happening, but it does weaken and slow it. Because the correction of past mistakes is not acknowledged, let alone celebrated, when the faithful encounter another serious problem in the institution and its teachings, they are paralyzed by fear of changing something that is supposedly eternal and infallible. They cannot benefit from the example of previous changes. For instance, when Catholics like Pope Francis himself are now reconsidering the Church's teachings on homosexuality, they find it difficult to simply acknowledge past mistakes and change the teachings. If eventually a future pope would issue an apology for the mistreatment of LGBTQ people, the way to do it would be to again shift the blame to the shoulders of some overzealous individuals who misunderstood the gospel. To maintain its religious authority, the Catholic Church has had no choice but to deny the existence of institutional self-correction. For the Church fell into the infallibility trap. Once it based its religious authority on a claim to infallibility, any public admission of institutional error, even on relatively minor issues, could completely destroy its authority. The DSM and the Bible. In contrast to the Catholic Church, the scientific institutions that emerged in early modern Europe have been built around strong self-correcting mechanisms. Scientific institutions maintain that even if most scientists in a particular period believe something to be true, it may yet turn out to be inaccurate or incomplete. In the 19th century, most physicists accepted Newtonian physics as a comprehensive account of the universe. But in the 20th century, the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics exposed the inaccuracies and limitations of Newton's model. The most celebrated moments in the history of science are precisely those moments when accepted wisdom is overturned and new theories are born. Crucially, scientific institutions are willing to admit their institutional responsibility for major mistakes and crimes. For example, present-day universities routinely give courses and professional journals routinely publish articles that expose the institutional racism and sexism that characterize the scientific study of subjects like biology, anthropology, and history in the 19th and much of the 20th centuries. Research on individual test cases, such as the Tuskegee syphilis study, and on governmental policies ranging from the White Australia policy to the Holocaust, have repeatedly and extensively studied how flawed biological, anthropological, and historical theories developed in leading scientific institutions were used to justify and facilitate discrimination, imperialism, and even genocide. These crimes and errors are not blamed on a few misguided scholars. They are seen as an institutional failure of entire academic disciplines. The willingness to admit major institutional errors contributes to the relatively fast pace at which science is developing. When the available evidence justifies it, dominant theories are often discarded within a few generations to be replaced by new theories. What students of biology, anthropology, and history learned at university in the early 21st century is very different from what they learned there a century previously. Psychiatry offers numerous similar examples for strong self-correcting mechanisms. On the shelf of most psychiatrists, you can find the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It is occasionally nicknamed the Psychiatrist's Bible. But there is a crucial difference between the DSM and the Bible. First published in 1952, the DSM is revised every decade or two, with the fifth edition appearing in 2013. Over the years, many disorders have been redefined, new ones have been added, while others have been deleted. Homosexuality, for example, was listed in 1952 as a sociopathic personality disturbance, but removed from the DSM in 1974. It took just 22 years to correct this error in the DSM. That's not a holy book. That's a scientific text. Today, the discipline of psychiatry doesn't try to reinterpret the 1952 definition of homosexuality in a more benign spirit. Rather, it views the 1952 definition as a downright error. More important, the error is not attributed to the shortcomings of a few homophobic professors. Rather, it is acknowledged to be the result of deep institutional biases in the discipline of psychiatry. Confessing the past institutional errors of their discipline makes psychiatrists today more careful not to commit new such errors, as evidenced in the heated debate regarding transgender people and people on the autistic spectrum. Of course, no matter how careful they are, psychiatrists are still likely to make institutional mistakes, but they are also likely to acknowledge and correct them. Publish or perish. What makes scientific self-correcting mechanisms particularly strong is that scientific institutions are not just willing to admit institutional error and ignorance, they are actively seeking to expose them. This is evident in the institution's incentive structure. In religious institutions, members are incentivized to conform to existing doctrine and be suspicious of novelty. You become a rabbi, imam, or priest by professing doctrinal loyalty, and you can advance up the ranks to become pope, chief rabbi, or grand ayatollah without criticizing your predecessors or advancing any radical new notions. Indeed, many of the most powerful and admired religious leaders of recent times, such as Pope Benedict XVI, Chief Rabbi of Israel David Lau, and Ayatollah Khamenei of Iran, have won fame and supporters by strict resistance to new ideas and trends like feminism. In science, it works the other way around. Hiring and promotions in scientific institutions are based on the principle of publish or perish, and to publish in prestigious journals, you must expose some mistake in existing theories or discover something your predecessors and teachers didn't know. Nobody wins a Nobel Prize for faithfully repeating what previous scholars said and opposing every new scientific theory. Of course, just as religion has room for self-correcting, so science has ample room for conformism too. Science is an institutional enterprise, and scientists rely on the institution for almost everything they know. For example, how do I know what medieval and early modern Europeans thought about witchcraft? I have not visited all the relevant archives myself, nor have I read all the relevant primary sources. In fact, I am incapable of reading many of these sources directly because I do not know all the necessary languages, nor am I skilled in deciphering medieval and early modern handwriting. Instead, I have relied on books and articles published by other scholars, such as Ronald Hutton's book, The Witch, A History of Fear, which was published by Yale University Press in 2017. I haven't met Ronald Hutton, who is a professor of history at the University of Bristol, nor do I personally know the Bristol officials who hired him or the Yale editorial team who published his book. I nevertheless trust what I read in Hutton's book because I understand how institutions like the University of Bristol and Yale University Press operate. Their self-correcting mechanisms have two crucial features. First, the self-correcting mechanisms are built into the core of the institutions rather than being a peripheral add-on. Second, these institutions publicly celebrate self-correcting instead of denying it. It is, of course, possible that some of the information I gained from Hutton's book may be incorrect, or I myself may misinterpret it. But experts on the history of witchcraft who have read Hutton's book and who might be reading the present book will hopefully spot any such errors and expose them. Populist critics of scientific institutions may counter that, in fact, these institutions use their power to stifle unorthodox views and launch their own witch hunts against dissenters. It is certainly true that scholars who oppose the current orthodox view of their discipline sometimes experience negative consequences, having articles rejected or research grants denied, facing nasty ad hominem attacks, and in rare cases, even getting fired from their job. I do not wish to belittle the suffering such things cause, but it is still a far cry from being physically tortured and burned at the stake. Consider, for example, the story of the chemist Dan Scheckman. In April 1982, while observing through an electron microscope, Scheckman saw something that all contemporary theories in chemistry claimed simply could not exist. The atoms in a mixed sample of aluminium and manganese were crystallized in a pattern with a five-fold rotational symmetry. At the time, scientists knew of various possible symmetrical structures in solid crystals, but five-fold symmetry was considered against the very laws of nature. Scheckman's discovery of what came to be called quasi-crystals sounded so outlandish that it was difficult to find a peer-reviewed journal willing to publish it. It didn't help that Scheckman was at the time a junior scientist. He didn't even have his own laboratory. He was working in someone else's facility. But the editors of the journal Physical Review Letters, after reviewing the evidence, eventually published Scheckman's article in 1984. And then, as he describes it, all hell broke loose. Scheckman's claims were dismissed by most of his colleagues, and he was blamed for mismanaging his experiments. The head of his laboratory also turned on Scheckman. In a dramatic gesture, he placed a chemistry textbook on Scheckman's desk and told him, "Danny, please read this book and you will understand that what you are saying cannot be." Scheckman boldly replied that he saw the quasi-crystals in the microscope, not in the book. As a result, he was kicked out of the lab. Worse was to come. Linus Pauling, a two-time Nobel laureate and one of the most eminent scientists of the 20th century, led a brutal personal attack on Scheckman. In a conference attended by hundreds of scientists, Pauling proclaimed, "Danny Scheckman is talking nonsense. There are no quasi-crystals, just quasi-scientists." But Scheckman was not imprisoned or killed. He got a place in another lab. The evidence he presented turned out to be more convincing than the existing chemistry textbooks and the views of Linus Pauling. Several colleagues repeated Scheckman's experiments and replicated his findings. A mere 10 years after Scheckman saw the quasi-crystals through his microscope, the International Union of Crystallography, the leading scientific association in the field, altered its definition of what a crystal is. Chemistry textbooks were changed accordingly, and an entire new scientific field emerged, The Study of Quasicrystals. In 2011, Shechtman was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his discovery. The Nobel Committee said that his discovery was extremely controversial, but eventually forced scientists to reconsider their conception of the very nature of matter. Shechtman's story is hardly exceptional. The annals of science are full of similar cases. Before the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics became the cornerstones of 20th century physics, they initially provoked bitter controversies, including personal assaults by the old guard on the proponents of the new theories. Similarly, when Georg Cantor developed in the late 19th century his theory of infinite numbers, which became the basis for much of 20th century mathematics, he was personally attacked by some of the leading mathematicians of his day, like Henri Poincaré and Leopold Kronecker. Populists are right to think that scientists suffer from the same human biases as everyone else. However, thanks to institutional self-correcting mechanisms, these biases can be overcome. If enough empirical evidence is provided, it often takes just a few decades for an unorthodox theory to upend established wisdom and become the new consensus. As we shall see in the next chapter, there were times and places where scientific self-correcting mechanisms ceased functioning, and academic dissent could lead to physical torture, imprisonment, and death. In the Soviet Union, for example, questioning official dogma on any matter, economics, genetics, or history, could lead not only to dismissal, but even to a couple of years in the gulag or an executioner's bullet. A famous case involved the bogus theories of the agronomist Trofim Lysenko. He rejected mainstream genetics and the theory of evolution by natural selection, and advanced his own pet theory, which said that re-education could change the traits of plants and animals, and even transform one species into another. Lysenkoism greatly appealed to Stalin, who had ideological and political reasons for believing in the almost limitless potential of re-education. Thousands of scientists who opposed Lysenko and continued to uphold the theory of evolution by natural selection were dismissed from their jobs, and some were imprisoned or executed. Nikolai Vavilov, a botanist and geneticist who was Lysenko's former mentor turned critic, was tried in July 1941 along with the botanist Leonid Govorov, the geneticist Georgi Karpachenko, and the agronomist Alexander Bondarenko. The latter three were shot, while Vavilov died in a camp in Saratov in 1943. Under pressure from the dictator, the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences eventually announced in August 1948 that henceforth, Soviet institutions would teach Lysenkoism as the only correct theory. But for precisely this reason, the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences ceased being a scientific institution, and Soviet dogma on genetics was an ideology rather than a science. An institution can call itself by whatever name it wants, but if it lacks a strong self-correcting mechanism, it is not a scientific institution. The limits of self-correction. Does all this mean that in self-correcting mechanisms we have found the magic bullet that protects human information networks from error and bias? Unfortunately, things are far more complicated. There is a reason why institutions like the Catholic Church and the Soviet Communist Party eschewed strong self-correcting mechanisms. While such mechanisms are vital for the pursuit of truth, they are costly in terms of maintaining order. Strong self-correcting mechanisms tend to create doubts, disagreements, conflicts, and rifts, and to undermine the myths that hold the social order together. Of course, order by itself isn't necessarily good. For example, the social order of early modern Europe endorsed, among other things, not only witch hunts, but also the exploitation of millions of peasants by a handful of aristocrats, the systematic mistreatment of women, and widespread discrimination against Jews, Muslims, and other minorities. But even when the social order is highly oppressive, undermining it doesn't necessarily lead to a better place. It could just lead to chaos and worse oppression. The history of information networks has always involved maintaining a balance between truth and order. Just as sacrificing truth for the sake of order comes with a cost, so does sacrificing order for truth. Scientific institutions have been able to afford their strong self-correcting mechanisms because they leave the difficult job of preserving the social order to other institutions. If a chemist finds that a thief has broken into their lab, or a psychiatrist receives death threats, they don't complain to a peer-reviewed journal. They call the police. Is it possible, then, to maintain strong self-correcting mechanisms in institutions other than academic disciplines? In particular, can such mechanisms exist in institutions like police forces, armies, political parties, and governments that are charged with maintaining the social order? We'll explore this question in the next chapter, which focuses on the political aspects of information flows and examines the long-term history of democracies and dictatorships. As we shall see, democracies believe that it is possible to maintain strong self-correcting mechanisms even in politics. Dictatorships disavow such mechanisms. Thus, at the height of the Cold War, newspapers and universities in the Democratic United States openly exposed and criticized American war crimes in Vietnam. Newspapers and universities in the totalitarian Soviet Union were also happy to criticize American crimes, but they remained silent about Soviet crimes in Afghanistan and elsewhere. Soviet silence was scientifically unjustifiable, but it made political sense. American self-flagellation about the Vietnam War continues even today to divide the American public and to undermine America's reputation throughout the world, whereas Soviet and Russian silence about the Afghanistan War has helped dim its memory and limit its reputational costs. Only after understanding the politics of information in historical systems like ancient Athens, the Roman Empire, the United States, and the Soviet Union will we be ready to explore the revolutionary implications of the rise of AI. For one of the biggest questions about AI is whether it will favor or undermine democratic self-correcting mechanisms. Chapter 5. Decisions: A Brief History of Democracy and Totalitarianism. Democracy and dictatorship are typically discussed as contrasting political and ethical systems. This chapter seeks to shift the terms of the discussion by surveying the history of democracy and dictatorship as contrasting types of information networks. It examines how information in democracies flows differently than in dictatorial systems, and how inventing new information technologies helps different kinds of regimes flourish. Dictatorial information networks are highly centralized. This means two things. First, the center enjoys unlimited authority. Hence, information tends to flow to the central hub, where the most important decisions are made. In the Roman Empire, all roads led to Rome. In Nazi Germany, information flowed to Berlin, and in the Soviet Union to Moscow. Sometimes the central government attempts to concentrate all information in its hands and to dictate all decisions by itself, controlling the totality of people's lives. This totalizing form of dictatorship, practiced by the likes of Hitler and Stalin, is known as totalitarianism. But not every dictatorship is totalitarian. Technical difficulties often prevent dictators from becoming totalitarian. The Roman Emperor Nero, for example, didn't have the means to micromanage the lives of millions of peasants in remote provincial villages. In many dictatorial regimes, considerable autonomy is therefore left to individuals, corporations, and communities. However, the dictators always retained the authority to intervene in people's lives. In Nero's Rome, freedom was not an ideal, but a byproduct of the government's inability to exert totalitarian control. The second characteristic of dictatorial networks is that they assume the center is infallible. They therefore dislike any challenge to the center's decisions. Soviet propaganda depicted Stalin as an infallible genius, and Roman propaganda treated emperors as divine beings. Even when Stalin or Nero made a patently disastrous decision, there were no robust self-correcting mechanisms in the Soviet Union or the Roman Empire that could expose the mistake and push for a better course of action. In theory, a highly centralized information network could try to maintain strong self-correcting mechanisms like independent courts and elected legislative bodies. But if they functioned well, these would challenge the central authority and thereby decentralize the information network. Dictators always see such independent power hubs as threats and seek to neutralize them. This is what happened to the Roman Senate, whose power was whittled away by successive Caesars until it became little more than a rubber stamp for imperial whims. The same fate befell the Soviet judicial system, which never dared resist the will of the Communist Party. Stalinist show trials, as their name indicates, were theatre with preordained results. To summarize, a dictatorship is a centralized information network, lacking strong self-correcting mechanisms. A democracy, in contrast, is a distributed information network, possessing strong self-correcting mechanisms. When we look at a democratic information network, we do see a central hub. The government is the most important executive power in a democracy, and government agencies therefore gather and store vast quantities of information. But there are many additional information channels that connect lots of independent nodes. Legislative bodies, political parties, courts, the press, corporations, local communities, NGOs, and individual citizens communicate freely and directly with one another, so that most information never passes through any government agency, and many important decisions are made elsewhere. Individuals choose for themselves where to live, where to work, and whom to marry. Corporations make their own choices about where to open a branch, how much to invest in certain projects, and how much to charge for goods and services. Communities decide for themselves about organizing charities, sporting events, and religious festivals. Autonomy is not a consequence of the government's ineffectiveness, it is the democratic ideal. Even if it possesses the technology necessary to micromanage people's lives, a democratic government leaves as much room as possible for people to make their own choices. A common misconception is that in a democracy, everything is decided by majority vote. In fact, in a democracy, as little as possible is decided centrally, and only the relatively few decisions that must be made centrally should reflect the will of the majority. In a democracy, if 99% of people want to dress in a particular way and worship a particular god, the remaining 1% should still be free to dress and worship differently. Of course, if the central government doesn't intervene at all in people's lives, and doesn't provide them with basic services like security, it isn't a democracy, it is anarchy. In all democracies, the center raises taxes and maintains an army, and in most modern democracies, it also provides at least some level of healthcare, education, and welfare. But any intervention in people's lives demands an explanation. In the absence of a compelling reason, a democratic government should leave people to their own devices. Another crucial characteristic of democracies is that they assume everyone is fallible. Therefore, while democracies give the center the authority to make some vital decisions, they also maintain strong mechanisms that can challenge the central authority. To paraphrase President James Madison, since humans are fallible, a government is necessary. But since government too is fallible, it needs mechanisms to expose and correct its errors, such as holding regular elections, protecting the freedom of the press, and separating the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. Consequently, while a dictatorship is about one central information hub dictating everything, a democracy is an ongoing conversation between diverse information nodes. The nodes often influence one another, but in most matters they are not obliged to reach a consensus. Individuals, corporations, and communities can continue to think and behave in different ways. There are, of course, cases when everyone must behave the same and diversity cannot be tolerated. For example, when in 2002-3, Americans disagreed about whether to invade Iraq, everyone ultimately had to abide by a single decision. It was unacceptable that some Americans would maintain a private peace with Saddam Hussein while others declared war. Whether good or bad, the decision to invade Iraq committed every American citizen. So also when initiating national infrastructure projects or defining criminal offenses. No country can function well if every person is allowed to lay a separate rail network or to have their own definition of murder. In order to make decisions on such collective matters, a countrywide public conversation must first be held, following which the people's representatives, elected in free and fair elections, make a choice. But even after that choice has been made, it should remain open to re-examination and correction. While the network cannot change its previous choices, it can elect a different government next time. Majority dictatorship. The definition of democracy as a distributed information network with strong self-correcting mechanisms stands in sharp contrast to a common misconception that equates democracy only with elections. Elections are a central part of the democratic toolkit, but they are not democracy. In the absence of additional self-correcting mechanisms, elections can easily be rigged. Even if the elections are completely free and fair, by itself, this too doesn't guarantee democracy. For democracy is not the same thing as majority dictatorship. Suppose that in a free and fair election, 51% of voters choose a government that subsequently sends 1% of voters to be exterminated in death camps because they belong to some hated religious minority. Is this democratic? Clearly it is not. The problem isn't that genocide demands a special majority of more than 51%. It's not that if the government gets the backing of 60%, 75%, or even 99% of voters, then its death camps finally become democratic. A democracy is not a system in which a majority of any size can decide to exterminate unpopular minorities. It is a system in which there are clear limits on the power of the center. Suppose 51% of voters choose a government that then takes away the voting rights of the other 49% of voters, or perhaps of just 1% of them. Is that democratic? Again, the answer is no, and it has nothing to do with the numbers. Disenfranchising political rivals dismantles one of the vital self-correcting mechanisms of democratic networks. Elections are a mechanism for the network to say, "We made a mistake. Let's try something else." But if the center can disenfranchise people at will, that self-correcting mechanism is neutered. These two examples may sound outlandish, but they are unfortunately within the realm of the possible. Hitler began sending Jews and communists to concentration camps within months of rising to power through democratic elections. And in the United States, numerous democratically elected governments have disenfranchised African Americans, Native Americans, and other oppressed populations. Of course, most assaults on democracy are more subtle. The careers of strongmen like Vladimir Putin, Viktor Orban, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Rodrigo Duterte, Jair Bolsonaro, and Benjamin Netanyahu demonstrates how a leader who uses democracy to rise to power can then use his power to undermine democracy. As Erdogan once put it, democracy is like a tram. You ride it until you arrive at your destination, then you step off. The most common method strongmen use to undermine democracy is to attack its self-correcting mechanisms one by one, often beginning with the courts and the media.